Hi, folks. Denise Howell here. And next up on This Week in Law, Mike Keyes and Matt Curtis join me. We've got a veritable animal kingdom on Twill today with Second Life bunnies and police dogs and palace cats and chipmunk emojis. In addition to some confusingly similar peas in the technology world, as well as the Eastern District of Texas biting the dust as a venue for patent litigation, and much, much more next on This Week in Law.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twill, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis. Episode 387, recorded May 26, 2017. Draco the dog and Crab the chipmunk. This episode of This Week in Law is brought to you by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor. For one low transparent fee, Betterment gives you personalized advice and invests your money. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. Learn more at betterment.com/twill. Hi, folks. Denise Howell here, and you're joining us for This Week in Law. My apologies for being a still photo if you are tuning in on our any one of our video options to enjoy the show. My internet went down right as we were about to start, but we are forging ahead with a couple of cell phones and cell phone connections on my end, and with my two wonderful co-hosts fully online on their ends. Hi, Mike Keyes. How are you?
Hola, amiga. I'm great. Great to be back. Sorry I missed you all last week, but I'm thrilled to be here this week.
Thrilled to hear you. Wish I could see you. Great to chat with you again. And Matt Curtis is with us as well. Hello, Matt.
Hi. Excited to be back, and just want to put out a travel advisory for anyone who wants to travel to the Eastern District of Texas and go ice skating. I'm assuming that the rentals are going to be cheaper on the hotels than they were last week.
That's good. And we're going to explain to you exactly what Matt is referring to. Yeah, Eastern District of Texas just became a bargain place to go vacation, I'm sure. So we'll tell you why as we get further into the show. Wanted to give you folks an update at the top of the show here. I was going to have Emery's email all queued up so that I could read it, but then internet issues ensued. But folks have been asking how Emery Roan is doing. He is studying for the bar exam right now. He is deep in bar study mode, but he is just fine. We just wanted to report in and let you know. He emailed me. I let him know that folks are thinking about him and wishing him all kinds of support and sending good thoughts to him. And he did email surface long enough to send me an email, let know he's okay, doing well and studying away. And the bar will be at the end of July. So between now and then, he is all about taking the monster test that is the California bar exam. I don't know if folks really realize who aren't lawyers, or maybe lawyers who aren't in California realize that the California bar is just a complete bear and is not getting any easier to manage or pass. It's given twice a year. Emory is taking the most popular bar at the end of July, the one that most people take. But there's also one in February every year. And the stats on the one in February in California said that if you were in the mostly two-thirds of people who took the test, almost all the way to two-thirds of the people who took the test failed it. So a little over a third passed. Yeah, it's just a monster experience. And I so feel for Emery right now. I remember I didn't surface for air really the whole time I was studying until the 4th of July weekend. And some friends kidnapped me and made me go somewhere with them. And it speaks to how focused you are on the bar that I really don't remember where we went. I know we went in a car. It might have been to Tahoe. It might have been to Lake Shasta. But really all I remember about that holiday weekend is studying for the bar exam in the back of that car. So there you go. Good luck,
delightful.
Emery. We are. Yeah. Our thoughts are with you. I was also thinking that, you want to be in that third of people who don't have to take it again, because taking it again, you know, you have to go through all the excruciating pain and focus and study once again. And I don't think you could pay me enough money to do that again. If you could guarantee me a post-scarcity, post-conflict world, if I took it again, I'd probably do it, but you'd have to go that far. On that note, good luck, Emery, and we'll get him on again, you know, as soon as he feels like he can speak and not be a basket case and not be focused on other things. So thank for sure. you for
best,
all your good,
best
good
of
thoughts
luck,
and
Emery.
Wishes. Yep. Best of luck. All right, we're going to start out this week's episode talking about an interesting copyright development. I love this story because it reminded me that two things still exist, Second Life and DRM figure prominently in this story. And specifically, we have a story of a bunch of virtual pets. Puffins, unfortunately, have already bitten the dust. And the Digi Rabbits, however, are holding on for dear life. These are animals that were made by Osmo, the company who created DigiPets. It closed last year. And there's some sort of dispute about the server that provided their food. And the person maintaining that server, I guess, was owed money by Osmo's. And wanted to shut it down, and some volunteer kept it online anyway, so that the poor little animals could continue to get their food and not die. But the volunteer got a cease and desist and decided to desist, and went ahead and let the server go down. So the puffins bit the dust right away, and the digital rabbits, I guess, have some sort of longevity based on the food that they've already consumed, and they're just gradually winding down now in a more slow and agonizing mode. And because their food is DRM'd, no one else can, you know, duplicate the food and provide the bunnies with food. So they're going away. The Osmo's bunnies, they go into a hibernation mode and only get woken up again if somebody provides them with food. So a moment of silence, if we could, for the puffins who are already gone and the digirabbits who are slowly meeting their sad foodless end. Mike, any thoughts about this?
Yes. I thought as soon as I read this article, I was certain that PETA was somehow going to try to step in and intervene and see about getting this DRM server back up and running to feed these poor rabbits.
But, Matt?
You know, I...
Yes.
That wasn't my first thought, but I kind of wish it was. I thought about I wanted to see the research into what people were willing to pay to buy the last of the food. I thought that would have been an interesting economic analysis of a system that's going down. But other than that, it was a really well written and really enjoyable article. I highly recommend it.
Yes, and we'll just remind folks, if they would like to see Boing Boing's coverage, and there was other coverage of this sad story, but we've got the link to the Boing Boing story in our public topic list, which is available at tagpacker.com. Find This Week in Law, the user, and we are show 387 this week. So, yeah, Matt, were you even aware that what Second Life was when you read this?
I'm still not quite aware of what it is other than these things. I'm not a gamer, and I mostly am in my books all the time. So I was not aware.
I'm sad to say that. We thought Second Life was going to be what everyone thinks virtual reality is going to be now, or augmented reality. You know, it was how things were going to be done. It was the future. People, politicians were holding town halls in there. People were having meetings in there. Real estate was being bought and sold in there. It was a big deal for a bit.
Is this the equivalent to like the Pokemon fad?
It lasted way longer than that. And apparently it's lasted way longer than that, because people are still in there with pets that need food. Mike, did you have a Second Life account at any point?
I did. It was at least a decade ago. And I'm sure I'm sure that's the last time I visited it too. But yes, there was all sorts of interesting kind of quirky things going on the last time I visited it, and hadn't given it much thought since then over the years.
It was a fascinating thing, and I guess still is. And I remember being really interested at the time, as you said, probably 10 years ago or so, at the digital currency issues about Second Life. And that certainly has blossomed into a whole world of its own, and a whole viable series of economies of their own. All right. So good luck, bunnies. We wish you well. Let's move on to discuss some trademark stories. Mike, this is up your alley, and we did not wind up discussing last week, though I wanted to. We shelved it because you were out of pocket last week. We have in the rundown this week the story of PayPal and Pandora, but prior to that was the litigation involving Google and Google's victory lately that the word Google has not become generic enough to strip Google of its trademark. In the story we have in the rundown, PayPal is suing Pandora, saying that its P infringes PayPal's P, or two P's, or shadow P's. I'm dying to get your take on all of this stuff. It seems, just for starters, that the Google case at least just strikes me intuitively as correctly decided. Do you agree?
I do agree. So the primary argument that was being made by Elliot, the plaintiff in that case, is that Google, because people use the term as a verb, i.e. go Google that, and use it in various other non-trademark ways, the argument was that it's become generic, and therefore it's become generic for simply searching the web. And when a trademark becomes generic, that means that anybody is entitled to use it. There's been lots of interesting trademarks over the years that started off as trademarks but ultimately became generic through people's use of the terms as a verb or otherwise. Some really good examples of that would be aspirin. That used to be a trademark owned by the Bayer company, and it has become generic. Some other really well-known generic trademarks, cellophane used to be a trademark of the DuPont company. Escalator used to also be a trademark. So lots of examples of terms that are used in kind of our everyday lexicon that used to be trademarks that were owned by a particular company. So that was the argument that was made by Elliot in this case, that Google had become generic because people use that term indiscriminately, or so the argument was, to search for the act of searching the web for content. And what the Ninth Circuit said, and I think I agree with you completely that the court got it right, that, well, just because consumers and others may use a term as a verb, a trademark term as a verb, that does not mean that it's become generic. What really counts at the end of the day and what we really look to is the primary significance of the term to the relevant consuming public. Once a term, the primary significance of which becomes generic in the minds of consumers, then it becomes generic as a matter of law. But that's not what Google has become. It's still a very, very strong brand. People associate that with a single source. And irrespective of the fact that it's used as a verb, it still retains very significant strength as a trademark. So that's the Google case in a nutshell.
Right. And Xerox still has the trademark to Xerox?
As far as I know, I mean, and that's another really good example of how people use a term Xerox. You know, people will say, oh, can you go Xerox this? Which really is exactly the functional equivalent of saying, hey, will you go Google that? You know, Xerox, like a lot of big brands do, they like to launch advertising campaigns to make sure that their mark does not become generic. So over the years, you've probably seen in magazines and in other media, Xerox had ads that it would say, hey, look, make sure you refer to our trademarks as a trademark. Don't use Xerox as a verb, and other similar advertising campaigns that make sure to point out for consumers the importance and the significance of the trademark so you don't run into a genericism problem.
Right. All right. Well, let's turn to PayPal and Pandora. A different issue there. Nobody's arguing that anything has become generic. What PayPal is more classically arguing is that Pandora's trademark is confusingly similar to its own, and that they are close enough in they can't really be arguing that they're offering the same sorts of services, because they're not. But they're making this interesting argument that they're in the same arena. They've asserted, and here's a quote, I believe, from their complaint: there's a demonstrable nexus between PayPal's and Pandora's services, starting with the fact that companies are in direct competition for precious real estate on the screens of consumers' mobile devices. Mm-hmm. Consumers also use PayPal to pay for their Pandora subscriptions. Now, Mike, you're more the expert in the field of trademark litigation, but both of those strike me as pretty feeble.
It's interesting. I wouldn't say feeble. I would say it's a little bit different take on some of the classic elements that we talk about in terms of trademark infringement and dilution. So typically we think of a classic case of trademark infringement being two competitors that are offering the same or similar types of goods or services. That tends to be a very important factor. And as you, I think, rightfully pointed out, Denise, PayPal and Pandora offer two different services. One is a payment processing service. One is providing music and other entertainment-related services. So they're both very disparate in that regard. But what's interesting here is in this commercial context, as PayPal pointed out in the complaint, look, we're competing. Our services overlap to the extent that we are both targeting consumers that use an iPhone, and we're competing for precious space on that particular device. So in that sense, our services overlap, even if they're not competing directly against each other. We are in the same channels of trade, which is an important factor. And the other factor that is particularly important in all cases, and I think in this one in particular, is there evidence of actual confusion in the marketplace? And PayPal went to great lengths to explain that there's been lots of instances where consumers apparently have been led to believe that Pandora is now somehow affiliated or associated or sponsored by PayPal as a result of changing the P logo. So that's an important factor in any case, whether there's actual confusion. So, you know, it looks like right. PayPal's alleging that there's been a significant amount of it. Now, it does, this case does raise the question as to, well, how significant or what are your rights associated in a simple letter? Can you really just have a protectable trademark with respect to the letter P? And you certainly can if it's recognized as such by consumers as coming from a particular source. And if you've also you don't need a registration, but if you have a trademark registration, that will further bolster the substance of your case as well. So it's a very interesting trademark related case, a little bit different as we were talking about a moment ago, the theory that's being alleged here as far as confusion, or at least the factors that are going to come into play. But it's going to be a very interesting case to watch play out. And Pandora, for its right. part, it had previously used a P. It's now modified its P to look apparently a little bit more like the Pandora P. So it is going to be interesting to see how this plays out. Pandora apparently has no interest in changing its particular look and feel.
Yeah, I think it's really fascinating. And the only reason this case exists is because of the realm of mobile apps, right? The importance of that little square with the rounded corners that appears on everybody's phone. And the fact that you mm-hmm. glance down, note what that square looks like, and click it to launch whatever app you need. And in this case, we have Pandora with a white background and a P that is not italics, for lack of a better description. And we have PayPal with a blue background and a pair of P's, I guess, indicating PayPal, or a shadow P. Neither P has... How do I describe this? Neither P has an open part in the middle of the round part. Mm-hmm. In other words, they are solid depictions of a P rather than how you might write it out if you were doing it in longhand. There's no open area in the middle. So I guess that font choice is perhaps a little confusing. The colors are similar, but it's not the identical font or logo. And I would think that the use of two P's rather than one P should play into the analysis here. But getting back to the issue of, you know, can you trademark a letter as your logo? And is that the answer to that question affected by the fact that a letter as a logo now means something that it didn't before? It means that's the app I want to use and I'm going to launch it. How do you think all that plays in, Mike?
I think that's going to be one of the key questions. From a pure trademark perspective, there's nothing problematic in my mind with a company claiming that a P or a shadow P or a PP or however we're referring to the mark as here. There's nothing that precludes somebody from claiming trademark rights associated with that particular design. At the end of the day, it's really all about whether consumers associate that particular logo or design or single letter with with a company that provides goods or services to the public. So there's nothing that strikes me as out of the ordinary with respect to that. It's a little bit different here because, I mean, it we're talking about just a single letter to the alphabet. Mm-hmm. Your points about you know, it's a different font, and one is the Shadow P and one doesn't have the Shadow P, and the Pandora one looks maybe a little squattier. I think that'll come into play. Certainly Pandora will be saying, look, the marks themselves are not identical. Yes, they have, they share some similarities, but we both have companies or services that start with P. So I've got to be able to use the letter P to signify, certainly in the context of an app on a mobile phone, that's really a shorthand way to refer to our particular business. This is probably one of those cases, like many trademark cases do, that will come down to a battle of the experts. If this case goes on for a while, presumably both sides will have consumer survey experts and market researchers that they will hire to either claim that there is actual confusion in the marketplace or there is not. So oftentimes that type of evidence can be really, really important for the court or the jury's ultimate consideration. And in trademark cases, it's difficult to get summary judgment. So either the case will probably settle or it'll go to trial. It seems like there's enough here that, you know, both sides will be able to, at least based on what we've seen so far, be able to create questions of fact as to whether the case should ultimately go to the jury. So it's going to be a fun case to see play out and see how the district court and maybe ultimately the appellate court deals with the issues.
Yeah, it will be. And what is up with peas? Was there ever a formal dispute between the Philadelphia Phillies and Pinterest over their pee?
You know, I don't know if there was that, but if you recall, there was a case from a couple of years ago, Pinterest and another company that used pee in its name.
That's right.
That was a case in the Northern District of California. And ultimately, if I'm recalling this correctly, that was a case where I think the court granted summary judgment saying that there was not sufficient evidence of confusion here. So yes, there are disputes over letter marks. It's not unheard of by any means.
Matt, anything pithy to add here?
I had a question for Mike. How novel is the theory that the real estate on the phone amounts to competition within the market? It seems that to the extent that you use that as a competition theory that blurs, that knocks away that requirement for anyone who has an app.
Yeah, I think that's right, Matt. I mean, to me, the more persuasive argument with respect to the parties competing on the phone, on the real estate of a smartphone or Apple – or excuse me, of a tablet – that argument to me seems better placed as a whether there's overlapping channels of trade, which is one of the elements that you consider in addition to how similar the marks are and whether there's confusion. It's an important consideration as to do these parties offer their goods or services in the same channel of trade. And I would say, I mean, if I was PayPal's attorney, I'd say absolutely. We compete on the identical trading channel here because we're competing for space on the consumers' tablets and other mobile devices.
All right. I think we've done the trademark peas to death here, but it will be interesting to see what happens there. Matt, I've been dying. I'm sure many listeners have been dying since the beginning of the show to know why the heck East Texas is a hot place to go on vacation. So let's talk about that.
So East Texas just got a – oh, sorry. We're doing the patent time.
Of course we are.
I'm missing all my cues.
Yes. All right. We need that patent bumper.
Yes. The Supreme Court, Justice Thomas wrote for the Supreme Court in a case called TC Heartland. It was one. It was not brought about concerning the Eastern District of Texas, but rather Delaware. But I think that everyone who was watching this or even knew about it knew that they were really talking about the Eastern District of Texas. So the Eastern District of Texas hears about 40% of the patent cases in the country. And as you can see on the picture there, they've got a Samsung ice rink in front of the courthouse, which is showing that it's somewhat problematic. So we're seeing 40% of the cases there. There was actually concern about whether there was enough jurors within the region to be so that the churn wasn't too much, so that jurors weren't hearing multiple patent cases. So what happened was in 1990, the Federal Circuit expanded venue to anywhere an item was sold. So for any item that was patented, where it was sold, the jurisdictional venue was valid. So what happened was that in the Eastern District of Texas, they were very patent friendly. So patent trolls and just generally companies that were litigating on a plaintiff's side would file there. And Judge Gilstrap was well known for having a very rigid schedule, and he kept. The outcomes were generally patent friendly. So TC Heartland overruled that. They said that 28 USC 1400, which provides specific venue statutes for patent litigation, the courts or legislature decided, I'm not sure which year, but they decided that patent was something special and that it needed to have certain venue rules. So it's now only where the company is incorporated that owns the patent and the company that actually does business. So in this case, there was a company in Indiana that didn't do business in Delaware, and so they brought suit on the basis of this.
Can you back up for a second and speak a little bit more to the Samsung Ice Arena in front of the courthouse? What the heck is that about?
It seems like a lot of fun. It also seems like a very good inducement to vote for Samsung on a jury. but this is – I mean when I just did a recent podcast on this and what – so administrators – when you talk about administrative law, you can think of a certain – you know the EPA or – certain administrations can be captured by their industry group. So that was one of the big problems that they were talking about with the BP Verizon spill, was that the regulators who were actually regulating that industry were induced to find answers that would be helpful to the companies that they're regulating. And so one of the large fears is that, as shown by this ice rink, is that the district court, the industry around Marshall, Texas, all built around these patent venues. There's a boom in housing prices. There's a boom in real estate development. It's almost 100% built on having patent cases there. Patent attorneys spend a lot of money. They go golfing. They do all these things that help the local economy. The cost of that, though, is that we're not getting fair and just outcomes. So that's the ice rink. I'm sure there's more things there, but that's just a really good emblem of something's going wrong.
Wow. Yeah. I could see a world where signage would have sprung up all around the courthouse in one form or another, but that's not going to happen now, because now, in the wake of the recent Supreme Court decision, it was just decided this week or last week?
This week. I wore my black earlier this week for the death of the Eastern District of Texas.
Yes, and there is a wonderful blog post by Michael Barclay to that effect, an obituary for the Eastern District of Texas as a patent litigation venue that you should check out if you're in the mood for some good law-related humor. But the rule now is, Matt, that patent defendants, right, have to be sued in the jurisdiction where they are headquartered, correct?
Where they are headquartered or where they actually do business. So this wouldn't strictly limit it to Delaware, where most companies are incorporated, but it would limit it only to the two states, Delaware and another state. I think there is concern that this will swing the other way. So we've been plaintiff friendly with patent suits. By having unique venue rules for patent patent rights holders, this could swing in the other way where you could see a court be captured, but only on the defendant's side. It's less likely because plaintiff's attorneys are specifically in one area. But the inequities of having a specific jurisdictional framework for patents is always going to be problematic. Because courts typically don't like to deal with patent cases. I mean, judges, when they get a patent case, aren't excited. This isn't what they went to law schools for. This isn't what they're prepared to do. You know, these are very technical fields that they're not experts at. And so they tend to get punted to the lowest member of the court. And, you know, when just like anything in our lives, when we don't want to deal with things, they pile up. And they piled up in the Eastern District of Texas, who is more than willing to take them.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt, I have a question about the. So I understand the court's ruling with respect to suing a patent defendant in the state in which it's incorporated, but the question I had was about the other portion or other place where they're doing business, whatever the language of the court's decision is. That's going to limit it. Certainly, the vast majority of cases that were filed in the Eastern District of Texas, the corporate defendants were not actively engaged in business there, at least under the TC Heartland standard. But if you're – what is it? Is it any state where you have employees or offices or – the warehouses, I mean, would that be sufficient enough of a nexus for there to be a patent suit brought there? Or is that still kind of left to be developed through the cases that are decided in the wake of TC Heartland?
From my understanding, this falls to general jurisdiction there. And there is there's a Supreme Court case which is going to come out in a couple of weeks, which is going to speak to general jurisdiction. But the problem is that for a sophisticated company, what you're going to do is you're going to house your patents within a certain company and limit where it's being done. So if your research is in one state, you're going to create a different C corp to hold only your patents there. And you're gonna limit that, and because it's intellectual property, and you can license it to your other companies, until the court breaks down that wall, or if they break down that wall, this is gonna really allow defendants to play to that. They will have to create another corporation, but that's not a barrier for any sophisticated company or really anyone who's making patents. It's gonna be advantageous for them to do that.
Great minds, Mike. That was my question as well. But now my follow-up to that is, does anybody think that companies are like Samsung and others are so fond of having their patent cases litigated in the Eastern District of Texas that they might incorporate and or headquarter there?
I think that they like filing lawsuits there. I don't think they like being the defendant in lawsuits there, because when they're the defendant in a lawsuit there, it's still plaintiff friendly. It's not like it's just Samsung friendly, although the ice skating rink might help with that. But I can't imagine unless the district swings the other way where they become defendant friendly. I can't see that.
Got it. All right. Well, RIP ED Texas. It's been fun while it lasted, and it will be fun seeing, you know, what sort of machinations go on now or if things swing the other way. Let's move on. We had a couple of fun criminal justice related stories. Let's get to those. Follow-up on the case that we discussed a while back, a few months ago, I think, at least a few months ago, involving the Geek Squad and the FBI. And when you bring your computer in for repairs, what happens if there are members of the Geek Squad at Best Buy is what was at issue here, in fact, in Orange County, in Mission Viejo, California. We're actively working with the FBI to provide them with information about what was on people's computers if they thought heinous crimes might be taking place. Here, It involved an image, and I think there's controversy on a couple of levels in this case. It was an image that may or may not have been child pornography. And the other sort of disputed point here, aside from the fact that there were issues with the manner of the search itself, where the Geek Squad is the direct pipeline to the FBI without any formal warrant. The other issue here is that the photo in question, whatever it may have been, was in unallocated space on the computer that could only have been accessed via specialized tools, etc. That here the owner of the computer itself didn't even possess. So what happened ultimately in this case, and just this week in this case, is that a district judge in California, Cormac McCarthy, decided that the evidence had to be suppressed. That the prosecution against this defendant as having possessed child pornography was going to have to exclude what they had found in this way via the Geek Squad letting the FBI know, both because the judge found that the image itself wasn't necessarily child pornography, and also because of the problematic way that the image found itself in the hands of law enforcement. Mike, anything that triggered in your mind from this case? Does it seem the right decision or the wrong decision?
Gosh, you know, I mean, I am a little bit conflicted over it. It mm-hmm. sounds like one further point of clarification, if I understand it correctly from the article, that it sounds like this mm-hmm. information was found by these informants at Best Buy, and then a search warrant was ultimately executed for this individual's home or office or something mm-hmm. where apparently they found additional incriminating evidence. It was ultimately, you know, ruled to be the quote unquote fruit of the poisonous tree,
right?
Because the original
right.
search was problematic. But I mean,
yeah.
We've talked about this case before. I think it's something that reasonable minds could maybe differ on. I mean, my thought would be, look, you don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy if you take your computer to a third party. I mean, barring there being some sort of contractual obligation by the Geek Squad people to make sure that everything is retained and held in private, you know, I'm not sure that you have a great reasonable expectation of privacy when you take some of your personal effects to a third party service provider. Now, mm-hmm. I could argue it the other way too, that, well, yes, you don't necessarily have a reasonable expectation of privacy that particular, Geek Squad employee isn't going to be able to look into the contents of your computer, but you certainly still have a reasonable expectation of privacy vis-a-vis the federal government. So,
right.
I think it's a tough decision. I mean, a tough one. I mean, I guess I come down personally on the line of, you know, although I am certainly a believer in the Fourth Amendment and understand the importance and significance of that, you know, when you part with your personal effects and give them to a third party, you do forfeit your reasonable expectation of privacy, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, I see where you're going, and it seems to me something else that needs to get fleshed out in this case, and maybe it will, you know, I'm assuming that whatever happens next, this issue may find itself before a higher court, the Ninth Circuit in this case is where it would go, for further analysis of this. And one of the things that seems problematic is any sort of indication or any way of demonstrating that, any particular individual put that image on the computer mm-hmm. and with the intent of, you know, enjoying child, if that's the right word, pornography. Because as I understand it, images can get on computers in various ways without anybody ever having actively downloaded them. They can be cached. They can be, you know, websites will populate images so that they don't have to display them again later. And sometimes, you know, I mean, if you just happen to have typed in a URL wrong and gone the wrong place and quickly gotten out of there, and it's stashed a bad image on your computer, you might have no way of knowing that. So I do feel like safeguards for people who have no idea what's getting put on their computers need to be taken into account in these kinds of investigations and prosecutions. Matt, what do you think?
I think I come out the other side than Mike. I think that where the reasonable expectation of privacy is yes, you have a reasonable expectation that something may be found on your computer, but it's unreasonable that the FBI is employing these agents for them at a hub in order to collect information. Our FISA court doesn't even allow. Our FISA court procedures doesn't even allow us to track terrorists in that invasive of a way. You have to have a reason. You have to have a belief that they're connected to a terrorist in some way before we can even track them. So the idea that we have Best Buy people working at a centralized location where everyone sends in their laptops or all their personal computers to actively search for it, not just to come across something, whether it's terrorism related, whether it's a photograph of a child pornographer, and no way am I standing for child pornographers in this instance. But the idea that we have them actively at a hub looking for this thing is very different than like your computer programmer who's fixing something for you finding it. So I was, although not sympathetic to the to the defendant, I think that they came out in the right way.
Right. And again, I don't think that this is probably the last word from a court on this issue. Number one, it could come up again in another case. And number two, this is only at the trial court level and will, I'm guessing, go further. So we'll keep an eye on it and let you know of future developments. And we'll significantly lighten things up in the next story that we have under Crimes, Justice, and Law Enforcement. This is from listener Simon Zafara, who gave us this story, even though there is no real tech law angle to it. Simon rightly points out that if we can't handle all the legal questions about police dogs effectively, how will we cope with all the legal questions about AI? And of course, that's just tongue in cheek, because this court seems to have handled the questions about police dogs just fine. The 11th Circuit was reviewing a decision from a Georgia trial court, which involved someone who was injured in the course of being apprehended as a suspect. And the police involved had canine units with them, and one of the canines was released and injured the suspect. And the opinion starts just beautifully. So I happen to have that here and could read it to you. Some legal opinions are approaching an art form, and I think this is one. In history and literature, the name Draco has been associated with some notorious characters. Draco of ancient Greece is perhaps best known for the harsh legal code he composed, which inspired the word draconian. Antonius Losides, Draco's Law, Ancient History Encyclopedia, etc., etc. Draco Lucius Malfoy, of course, is Harry Potter's perpetually maleficent rival in the Harry Potter literary series. Add to the list of infamous Dracos, defendant appellant Draco. Draco is a police canine who was involved in the apprehension of plaintiff Randall Kevin Jones. Unfortunately, Draco inflicted some serious damage on Jones when Draco refused to release his bite. Jones sued Draco, among others, for negligence. Georgia law, by its terms, however, does not provide for negligence actions directly against dogs. So Draco and his officer colleagues were let off the hook here by the 11th Circuit. Draco, because you can't bring a negligence action against a dog. And once again, Pete, I may have something to say about that, Mike. And the fellow officers were found to have qualified immunity and not to have exceeded the bounds of their immunity in letting the police dog apprehend the suspect. So have at it, boys. What do you think, Mike?
I agree with you. I loved the opinion. I thought it was just brilliant. I particularly liked the court's analysis about how Draco can't be a person for a variety of reasons, not the least of which, you know, how that raises all sorts of complicating questions. Like, how would you go about effectuating service on Draco the dog? And how would Draco ultimately retain counsel? I mean, so you've got some pretty pressing questions there with respect to, you know, defining a pet or a dog as a person under the statute. Obviously, a very, very good decision and the right decision by the court, as far as I can tell. Now, I am curious to know if PETA filed like a friend of the court brief or saying or something saying that, well, you know, dogs should be treated as persons.
I would think PETA would feel otherwise in this particular case. PETA
It wouldn't because, of course, PETA would not want Draco to stand trial for its negligence. Mm-hmm. But, PETA might say, look, despite the fact that an adverse ruling could be entered against Draco, we do want to, you know, advocate that Draco has the same rights as an individual does. So, you know, it would be a difficult position for PETA to take, of course. But, you know, we've seen other positions, i.e. in the Naruto case that, I don't know. Maybe PETA needs to take a look at this case.
Maybe it does. Maybe they should intervene. Be consistent across the various cases and ensure that if animals are to be treated as persons, that they, as you say, intervene in all possible instances of that. Matt, any thoughts?
The first one is that I think that they misinterpreted Draco Malfoy. I think that he ended up being a better character and they should revise that statement. The second one is despite that, I did send in my application for a clerkship there. And because that would be great to write opinions like that. And I did think about FOIAing Draco and seeing if we could get an animal selfie from him, but I resisted the temptation.
Oh yeah, that's good.
Feature it if you get it. Let us know. It will definitely make animal selfie of the week.
That may qualify as frivolous in some sense, but we'll see.
All right. We're going to get to some issues involving legislation, regulation, and policy in just a moment here. But before we do, we'd like to thank our sponsor. This Week in Law this week is brought to you by Betterment, the largest independent online financial advisor that serves one purpose, to help you make the most of your money. Betterment takes proven investment strategies that have been around for decades and uses technology to deliver them to more than 250,000 customers. Based on your financial planning needs, you get personal advice for retirement planning, building wealth, and other financial goals. Betterment invests your money, working to lower taxes and increase returns. On average, Betterment's tax-coordinated portfolio can increase portfolio value by an estimated 15% over 30 years. Betterment gives you a clear view of your net worth when you sync your outside accounts, such as bank accounts and other investments. Another reason to choose Betterment: low transparent advisory fees compared to traditional services. Only 0.25% on assets under management, with the option to upgrade to 0.40% or 0.5% for access to a CFP or licensed financial expert. If you want to talk to someone about your specific financial situation, you can access their team of licensed financial experts. Betterment cares about keeping your money and data secure, which is why they have advanced data encryption and login protection. Investing involves risk. For a limited time, you can get up to 6 months managed for free. For more information, visit betterment.com/twill. That's betterment.com/twill. Betterment, rethink what your money can do. Thank you so much, Betterment, for your support of This Week in Law. All right, a couple of things have been going on the legislative front. Let's take a look at them. So as a the FCC's privacy rules that wound up not being implemented of involving ISPs. We have an alternative coming to the fore in Congress now. It's called the Patch Act, and it is getting mixed reviews. Can you tell us more about this, Mike?
Is this the one that was introduced by the Congresswoman from Tennessee? Is that what we were talking about, the Patch Act?
The Patch Act, yes.
Right. So as I understand it, this is a piece of legislation being proposed in the House that would treat ISPs, i.e. the Comcasts of the world, and also edge providers like Google and Facebook, and it would preclude any ISPs or edge providers from providing information regarding your search history with third parties unless you have allowed them to do so. I think that's essentially the scope of the legislation or the proposed legislation.
Right. Right.
So go ahead.
Opt-in consent would be required before using web browsing history and application usage history for advertising and other purposes, and in order to share that information with other entities.
Right.
So at least we have this on the table.
Hotly contested.
Right. This is brand new, and it's just starting to come under scrutiny. The EFF doesn't think it's perfect. I think it and other privacy advocates would much rather have seen the FCC's rules that were supposed to have gone into effect, but were rolled back by joint resolution of Congress. Those would have had greater force, but at least we're starting to see legislators address, I think, some of the outcry around that. And again, this is in the very nascent stages. It hasn't been passed yet. It's just been introduced. Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that this is kind of the same argument we heard when the FCC came out that companies like Google should be treated the same as companies like Time Warner. I think that it misses the distinction that you're working with Time Warner and Comcast and these companies. You know, they're able to use eminent domain and all these different kind of legal rules that give them a bonus to get into your house to provide a public service, or it's almost like a gateway to the internet. And to treat them the same and to legislate them the same as someone like Google, which every time you go to Google, you have to opt into. Obviously, you know, there may be antitrust issues with Google where they have monopoly power. But by definition, these companies like Time Warner and Comcast have the ability to extract monopoly profits. And it's there where the privacy, I think, is the more concern. I think it's from a basic concept of where regulation is best used. It's best used where they have the most capability of perpetuating bad policies, and they do. They're like the classic railroad, which required regulation. And so treating them the same is going to make it less likely that this legislation is going to pass, because you're going to see companies like Google, you're going to see every startup company that's going to have to face this regulation where they're going to have to put in specific provisions to opt in. It increases the price of that without seeing the benefit of the monopoly pricing and the decreased competition on the local level. I do think that the Republican point is that, like, this should have been done through Congress is a fair one. And I just wish they would have passed exactly what the FCC said before. So, but I guess I was surprised that anything came out. So,
right. You know, there may be two pieces of legislation that I'm getting confused here. Is that what you were referring to, Mike? This one might be the Browser Act, and the Patch Act is something separate, the Protecting Our Ability to Counter Hacking or Patch Act. introduced right.
Sorry, that
by,
may have been my fault.
Yes. Right. No. I had them lumped together in the rundown and thought they were the same, but they're not. They're two different things. We've got one, the Browser Act, that is what we've been discussing here. And then the Patch Act is aimed at, as we were discussing WannaCry last week, having a serious discussion about what should be done to address vulnerabilities to make sure things are not subject to being taken over as they were in the case of the WannaCry incident. So that's the one that EFF thinks could go a lot farther in making sure that we're making disclosures and patching vulnerabilities in hardware and software. Again, just freshly introduced before Congress and getting feedback from folks like the AFF. So perhaps it can evolve to the point where it will be effective and helpful. We've now got the FCC net neutrality proposal on the table, as we discussed last week. Interesting point that the FCC has decided not to disregard all of the anti-net neutrality comments it received by various bots that were peppering the site. And so, as we discussed last week, we're rolling toward fall in getting something final from the FCC on net neutrality. Not sure if you guys want to discuss anything further about net neutrality this week. Mike, anything from you?
I don't think I have anything further to add to the conversation already.
Okay. Matt?
Yeah. I'm not surprised that they're ignoring these. I think that, like, generally, like, it's a requirement by the law when an administrative procedure is going in that it allows a comment section. I don't know what the statistics are, but I would be surprised if there's very much effect on what those comments are, regardless if they're bots or people. So
right.
Whether they calculate it or not, I thought that was kind of irrelevant. But I thought it was kind of ridiculous that they said they were going to count them. It's just not good PR. So
right. And then we have a drone-related story following up on our tip of the week from last week about dodging drone regs by running a pattern around them if you can. You could also sue about them, which is what one gentleman named John Taylor has done, and he's successfully gotten a decision out of the D.C. Circuit. He has other litigation also pending about various other aspects of the FAA drone regs. But what the D.C. Circuit has agreed with John Taylor about is if you have a drone that is used for non-commercial purposes in a hobby and recreational way, and the FAA rules say you would have had to pay $5 and register it. We've talked a lot about this over the time that this rule has been in effect. You no longer have to comply with that registration rule, according to a federal circuit court now. The court found that the FAA had exceeded its authorization in making this rule, and that hobby recreational flyers who are defined in various ways by statute, one of the ways is flying line of sight. So if you have a drone that can fly beyond your line of sight and you fly it that way, or if you are a person interested in getting into drone racing using FPV, first-person view, in order to pilot your drone. And again, if you're in drone racing, you may be getting paid. So that that takes out the non-commercial part possibly for you. But also the line of sight thing is important. So if you're flying beyond line of sight, you're still going to have to register. And if you're flying commercially, you're going to have to comply with all the commercial drone requirements. And whether you're flying recreationally or not, you're still going to have to comply with all the safety rules. So the only thing that has been lifted here is the registration requirement, but that's still pretty welcome for lots of people. And I'm really interested to find out what happens to the several million dollars in fees that the FAA has already taken in from diligent people who've registered their drones. We're going to try and get John Taylor on the show before too long. I know, Matt, you've been chatting with him.
Yeah, he's very interested in coming on. We just got to find a date for him.
Great. So I'm really anxious to talk to him. He is an, I believe, an insurance lawyer and a drone enthusiast who decided to take it on himself to bring a couple of pieces of litigation where he's called into question the scope and authority of the FAA drone rules. He was also trying to, in the case where he did away with the registration requirement, he was trying to have the FAA address various no-fly zones in D.C. And have those lifted. And he was unsuccessful in that part of the case. So one other really interesting thing in the fallout of this that I saw was we've talked about on the show before how the FAA has steered clear of wading into whether it's their responsibility to keep drones from peeping in people's windows, that kind of thing. They're not, they haven't stepped up and said they are the regulatory body that should be engaging on issues of drone privacy. But they've kind of let that go in responding to Mr. Taylor's case here. In its press release about the case, the FAA pointed out that its drone regulations are very important to public safety and privacy. So we may be seeing a bit of a shift in the FAA there as to what they think their role is with respect to these kinds of craft. Any thoughts, Mike?
Yeah, it's interesting. I did note the privacy issue that you just raised. So that'll be very interesting for us to follow. Super excited to have Mr. Taylor on the show and find out more of the backstory and how he went about doing this challenge. I mean, he is a lawyer. I noted in the court's opinion that he represented himself. So it'll be good to hear, you know, how he went about doing that. It sounds like he must have done it below and before the circuit court as well. So be great to have him on.
Yeah, that will be fun. Also, there's just on May 22nd, someone flew a drone into Petco Park, the stadium where the San Diego Padres play, and crashed the thing in there. So I'm sure that the FAA will have something to say about that, whether or not that drone was registered. Matt, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I just think about this guy who's working in a different area and just had like an issue and he just went out and litigated it. It just makes me very happy that this happened. On the second thing, one of the interesting claims that he's bringing, or I think he's bringing, additionally, which will be interesting to hear him talk about it, is an ad coelum doctrine claim, which ad coelum is a Roman law concept where ownership of property in general, like if you own the land itself, you own what's below the land, and so you have the mineral rights, and you also own the sky above. So when aviation first started in the early 19th century, it was a big question before the court in order for flying whether it was a trespass to fly over someone's house. And I think he's challenging this. I think he'll lose because modern aviation and all of our concepts in the last 100 years have been, don't align with that. But I do think it's great that, these old Roman law concepts are coming back.
Yeah, it'll be fascinating to speak with him about that and get the lowdown on where that case is and if he has any sort of indication as to how it might come out. Hey, Victor in the studio, I know we told you that our last batch of stories we were going to cover today were the legislation and policy ones, but I'd love to do a social web law one before we're out of here, if you can cue up that bumper for us, or maybe put it in later. There we go.
He's good.
So, Matt and Mike, I don't know if you thought that we were living in a world where a court might not consider a chipmunk emoji as evidence that someone didn't have good faith when they were negotiating a contract. But we do. We do live in that world, because that seems to be what happened in Israel. Professor Goldman and one of his law students specifically, I'm going to have to pull up the article to get her name, since it's not right in front of me on the tiny phone screen I'm looking at to do this show. Gabriella Ziccarelli wrote this up at Professor Goldman's Technology and Marketing Law blog. It's about a tenant who was sued by a would-be landlord in Israel. The two of them were discussing the person renting, I believe, an apartment. The person expressed a lot of interest in the apartment and sent some texts that included some emojis that the court found to be evidentially significant. In other words, the emojis, in addition to the actual words that were exchanged, were considered in whether the landlord was misled by the would-be tenant into taking the step of keeping the property off the market and holding it for the tenant. And ultimately the tenant backed out, or the would-be tenant backed out and didn't take the place. And they were hit with a judgment of, I think, the equivalent of $2,200 for having done so. And what's wild about this case is the series of emojis that were sent. They involved the dancing girl, the sort of Spanish dancer girl, the two twin dancing girls, a peace sign, V for victory sign. I don't even know what that fourth thing is. It sort of looks like a streak of light or water. Then we have the chipmunk and a bottle of champagne. And what the court decided here is that this, you know, the various smileys and this sort of strange chipmunk peppered text were a basis for the would-be landlord here concluding, oh, this person's really excited about this apartment, so I'll go ahead and hold it for them. And the conclusion to the blog post over at the Technology and Marketing Law blog is that it's a good reminder that we anticipate courts are going to see lots of emoji issues, and they may not be fully prepared for the onslaught. I think Professor Goldman and his law student author here thought that the court maybe read too much into the emojis, overanalyzed them. Professor Goldman, though, has a whole paper on emojis and the way that they are impacting law and are poised to continue to do so in just this way, and in trying to parse out people's intent in their communications. So really funny and fascinating case, not so funny for the would-be tenant who got hit with quite a lot of, well, you know, $2,200. So to me, that's a lot of money. It's not a high dollar, high powered piece of litigation, but you know, for failing to follow through and rent an apartment and having sent a chipmunk emoji, seems like a pretty stiff penalty. What do you think, Mike?
Oh, yeah. Well, one, I read the article. I thought it was wonderful. I actually just communicated with Gabriella earlier today telling her how much I liked it. But it's really shocking. I mean, I don't think that something like this would happen here in the U.S., but I'm not an emoji law expert by any means. But it struck me as I was reading through this, and Matt, you'll maybe be able to help us out because you're much closer to this Denise and I, but it seemed like what this court was ultimately articulating, if I put it in kind of U.S. common law terms, was promissory estoppel. This landlord was apparently led to believe that this person really had a serious interest in renting the apartment. She ultimately backed out, and therefore she is estopped from essentially denying that she intended to rent the apartment. So, and here I thought, it's been 20 plus years since I've been out of law school, but here I thought the doctrine of promissory estoppel was just something that you learned about in your first year of contracts class, but little did I know that a court in Israel is talking about promissory estoppel with respect to emojis. Who would have thought?
That's right. We've got cases being impacted by app logos and now by emojis with really old, hoary kinds of legal doctrines altered by our new technologies and the fact that they now need to be applied there. Matt, anything to add?
Denise, I should point out that one little quirky looking emoji is apparently a comet.
Yeah. Oh, it's a comet. I've actually used that one before. I couldn't tell. there's so many emojis that you just don't even know what they are. Matt, what do you think?
I think Mike's got it dead on the promissory estoppel. It is used a little bit in litigation, but it tends to happen in the case of like businesses who regularly do business. I can't imagine any state court saying that this was promissory estoppel. I think we tend to be rather renter friendly, and I think that's a good. But I really think that the judge here was just looking for a way to bond with his daughter or son, and really needed to get into what emojis meant and what their life meant, and he found a way here. But it is interesting just to compare how contract law works. And I did send this off to my professor and tried to get him to put it on the exam for next year.
Perfect. I wish you well
nice
with
work.
That. Be a good one. And just getting back to Emory at the top of the show, can you imagine when the bar exam starts to include contract interpretation questions that involve use of emojis? That can't be too far in our future. In fact, we'll have to see if Emory gets peppered with that this time around. Until then, though, we can't end a show without giving you an animal selfie of the week, and we've got one ready for you. Just to set the stage for what sort of animal selfie we will be looking at here, it would be the sort that involves someone setting up a trap camera and hoping they get some good footage. They did indeed hear of a palace cat. Could you play that for us, Victor?
Here he comes. Extreme close up.
I don't know if we can make the cat as videographer argument here, since the camera was rolling regardless of what the cat did. But the cat did facilitate that wonderful extreme close-up.
It looks like the cat was looking for the focus ring, so.
Yeah,
I think that's
exactly.
There you go.
They do. And, how can you not love a good palace
selfie.
Cat? Yes, the cat. Saw the opportunity and seized it. And I, for all I know, I'm not quite sure. I did a little bit of sleuthing around about this particular bit of footage to see if it was the stuff of meme legend. I did see that at least one person put in an audio track imagining what was going through the palace cat's head as it came up and checked out the camera. That one was pretty good. Some Australian guy did that. Other than that, I'm sure that it has quite a following. It had over 3.9 million views on YouTube, I think, that particular clip. So thank you, Palace Cat, for being our animal selfie of the week. We have a resource of the week for you. Both our tip and our resource are privacy focused this week. The resource was created by the Parent Coalition for Student Privacy in collaboration with the Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. And it is called the Parent Toolkit for Student Privacy, a practical guide for protecting your child's sensitive school data from snoops, hackers, and marketers. Is a really, really useful PDF you can download if you're a parent. And it helps you navigate. You know, I think people are concerned about their kids' privacy, but at the same time, they don't want to be that parent who's in making a stink with the office and trying to get people to provide information and documents that maybe they're not used to providing or they don't even know the answers to. So it really helps you navigate that water diplomatically. So try and avoid being that parent, but be that parent enough so that your school district is at least thinking about what it's collecting and how it's using the data and knowing that parents are attuned to these issues and looking out for them. So take a look at that if you are a parent. And if you are a Twitter user, you might have noticed that Twitter has a new privacy policy. And the way that you might have noticed that is you might have gotten this screen on your device that says, you know, has the nice little Twitter logo, and it says, we're updating our privacy policy to bring you a more personalized Twitter experience. We're working with ad partners in new ways to improve the tailored ads you already see, and we've given you even more control over your data. And then they do this thing that everybody does, and I really, really hate it. And if I can make this a double tip of the week, the first tip is how to change your settings if you went ahead and clicked sounds good on this, where they gave you the big button that says sounds good, and then below that with no button is a link that you could have clicked that said review settings. So twofold tip. Number one is how you can go ahead and change those settings if you went ahead and clicked sounds good, because you might want to change those settings. And number two is if you are at all in charge of user experience and user interface in presenting policy changes to people, this is not a great way to do it, where you're highlighting the link that gives you the information grab and downplaying the other link where people can go in and tweak the settings and may want to. It's just, you know, not very customer friendly to do it this way. And I think even worse, you know, at some point in the future, we're talking about, for goodness sake, how emojis can impact a court's analysis of a decision. I think practices like this would certainly be a factor that a court would look at if they were trying to determine whether a company had acted in good faith or not. So fair warning, Twitter, I don't think this is a great way to implement this kind of a change. So what would have happened if you clicked on sounds good is you wound up giving the default access for Twitter to implement two new targeting options and a new tracking option. All of that is set to track and target by default had you clicked sounds good here. Twitter also made a change where they're going to be saving off Twitter browsing records for up to 30 days, and that's up from 10 days under the prior policy. So not to fear, if you did fall prey to this little UI trick and click sounds good because that sounded good, you can still go into your Twitter settings. You have to click review settings to do that. You can opt out of those new mechanisms for tracking. You're going to have to do that under the personalization and data section of your settings. EFF has a good piece directing you through all of this that you can find in our discussion points for today. They also suggest that you might want to go into the Your Twitter Data section of your settings and make sure you're okay with everything that is set up there. So just a good reminder of a bunch of things in connection with this rollout of Twitter's new privacy policy, and they're opting people into those settings. Any thoughts on this matter, Mike?
Nothing further from my end. I think you hit the nail right on the head with it does look a little nefarious.
Mm-hmm. And you see it everywhere now. I mean, this is not unique to Twitter.
Totally.
This is a very ubiquitous kind of practice. So something to keep an eye out for. I'll also give a shout out to listener Jonathan Annette, if I'm saying your last name correctly, Jonathan, for recommending a great book that came out just about a year ago. I just started it. I'm really enjoying it. It's right sort of obliquely in line with what we've been talking about on the privacy front here. It's called Kill Process. I forget the author now. I had the tab queued up on my computer before my internet died. But look up the book Kill Process, or one of you look it up for me now and say who the author is. But I will say in the meantime.
How do you spell that?
Kill Process. It is about someone working on the inside of a very Facebook-like social network who has taken it upon themselves to do some vigilante justice based on their ubiquitous access to everyone's information. And it's really well written from a technical standpoint. Not being a technologist myself, I certainly can't poke holes in it, but it seems to be very technologically sound in the way that the woman who is the protagonist here is declining to use, for example, Tor the Onion router, and the reasons that she gives for that, why it might be not as secure as people may think in the wake of the apprehension of Ross Ulbricht and taking down of Silk Road, the analogy the narrator gives there you'll have to read the book. It had something to do with, I know what it was. It was Enigma. She points out, the author points out through his female narrator, we certainly didn't let the Germans know when we had cracked Enigma, and that she doesn't feel like the NSA would let anybody know that Tor had been compromised, if indeed it had. So she, is a very technologically savvy analyst within this social networking company, and her own technological measures and what she's doing within the company are all really fascinating. Plus the whole notion that one would take it upon themselves from within an organization like that to use the data. We've wondered and talked about instances where we think people have been using data for bad purposes. This person is definitely using the data for bad purposes, but with good motives. So check out the book if you get a chance. It's a fascinating read. And
William Hertling, Denise.
Thank you very much. William Hertling wrote this book, and Jonathan Annett recommended it. Thank you, Jonathan. What else shall we tell you? I have not put any MCLE passphrases into the show, so I'm going to put two in here toward the end, so that if you are listening to the show for continuing legal education credit, you can demonstrate that you watched or listened to the show by trotting out these phrases. The one I'm going to do first is bad UI design, referencing our discussion from the tip of the week. And as we say goodbye here, I'm going to let Mike or Matt come up with another one. Mike, so great to have you back on the show. Sad to have missed you last week. Tell us, is anything new going on that we should know about in Mike's life?
Well, thank you. Yes, I missed being with you all last week. I just returned yesterday from Barcelona. I was there for 5 days
the
International Trademark.
I
was there for INTA, which is the International
Speaking, yes, of social networks and the information you can glean from them. all of a sudden half my network was in Barcelona. I wasn't quite right. sure why.
Yeah, so apparently there were somewhere around 11,000 trademark attorneys and related professionals that were there in Barcelona mm-hmm. for INTA, which is the big International Trademark Association meeting. It's held every third year outside of the U.S. I'd never been to Spain, loved my time in Barcelona. It went by way too quickly, but had a great time, met with lots of colleagues and old friends and clients, and it was just a really wonderful event. We are hosting INTA in Seattle next year, which will be our third time in recent memory. So we're looking forward to that already.
Oh, that's great. Seattle next year. I may have to make it up for that one. Sounds
yes,
like it could be a good time.
Sure. You'll have to come to our reception and dinner.
That would be really fun. Thank you for that. Hey, Matt, what's new with you?
We do have a new podcast on the Eastern District of Texas. It kind of now it's historical, and that's great. But I wanted to make a plug for next week. We've got Zoe from Colorado, and she's a privacy attorney, and so she's going to be on Twill. She's written some really great articles, and looking forward to having her on.
Great. I am Super. Too. Thanks so much for that. And I came up with a second MCLE passphrase if neither of you have one you want to talk
to.
No, that's okay. It just it popped into my head while Matt was talking, and that would be RIPEDT.
Yes.
Yes. So for those of you who need your passphrases, there you go. There they are. And thank you so much for joining us for this episode of This Week in Law. All of you, whether you need a passphrase or not, it's been super fun going through the stories we've discussed today with my wonderful co-hosts, Mike and Matt, and with all of you folks who tune in with us each and every week. Or if this is your first time, welcome. We're so thrilled that you've found our show. We hope you will come back again. If you want to do that, we record this show every Friday at 11 o'clock Pacific Time, 1800 UTC. You can go to twit.tv/live to watch with us live as we record and deal with our various network issues as they may arise. If you want the more polished and or on-demand version of the show, you can head on over to twit.tv/twill. Our whole archive of shows is there for you, and you can enjoy them at your leisure on your device of choosing. All the instructions for doing that are right there. And we do hope you will get in touch with us between the shows. We love hearing your book recommendations and cases about dogs in Georgia and anything else that you might want to throw our way. Really, really fun to get your feedback and participation in the show. You can email us. Mike is mike@twit.tv. Matt is mattc@twit.tv. And I'm denise@twit.tv. You can also find us on Twitter and on Facebook. Let us know what's on your minds, guests you might want to suggest for the show, topics you might want to suggest, et cetera, et cetera. Just let us know. Give us a shout, whatever's on your mind. We love hearing from you. And we will see you and our guest Zoe next week on This Week in Law. Take care, everyone.